The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting Yes And is Ori Brofman. Ori has an MBA in organizational studies from Stanford Business School and consults with and speaks to Fortune 500 companies on organization, disruption, and innovation. Brofman is the co-author of the New York Times bestsellers Sway, The Starfish and the Spider, and The Chaos Imperative. He works closely with the U.S. Army and has a new book coming out next month called Radical Inclusion that is co-written with General Martin E. Dempsey. Ori Brofman, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm great. All right. In reading your work, I found a ton of crossover to the work we do in improvisation-based arts and education. Most of the early improvisational exercises are a kind of unlearning, getting individuals to abandon their need to be right, allowing them to put their full focus on others, and getting comfortable with risk and failure. So I'm curious at your journey in discovering these ideas. Did you have to fight your own default behaviors in order to fully understand concepts like chaos and decentralization?
Absolutely. So, going through school and growing up in this country, you definitely have this notion that the more order that you have, the more effective you're going to be. Mm-hmm. My big learning was actually on September 10th, 2001. Mm-hmm. I was on a plane from Boston to San Francisco, and obviously the world changed the next day. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do something to make a difference, and I created a network of CEOs working on peace and economic development issues behind the scenes. And the people who supported the initiative had a couple of questions. One was, who was in charge? And I was like, no one's in charge. I was 26 years old. I wasn't going to tell a bunch of CEOs how to run things. And the second question was, what's the strategy? And the strategy was to actually just build a network. Mm. It wasn't to have a concrete 10-point plan for Middle East peace. And it turned out that the circles that abided by the improvisational concepts were the most effective. The biggest one was probably India and Pakistan, where they ended up opening up the borders between the two countries. People are like, how did you achieve this? And it's through trying to explain the success of that network that we researched the concepts of the starfish and the spider, and specifically about distributed organizations and their ability to be very adaptive and improvisational.
So in further digging into like what the problem is, right, you have a great quote, which is, quote, the overhanging canopy of an organization's structure can sometimes block out too much sunlight to allow new ideas to grow. So this is along the lines of that idea of like structure can sometimes actually be a disservice.
Right. So that we oftentimes look at variance as kind of a bad thing in an organization, right? Mm-hmm. You want to be able to predict the future as effectively as you can. But in order to be able to be responsive to an uncertain future, you need to accept a certain level of variance. Mm-hmm. And you can't have just the good stuff. You need to kind of take the good and the bad. Mm-hmm. You need to figure out ways of supporting the amplification of the positive innovations.
Mm. And you talk about chaos creating white space, right? And that's the place that you are playing in when you're kind of inside chaos.
Exactly. So that you I look at this from a very micro level, right? In your day, how much time are you devoting to really give yourself space to have unstructured conversations, unstructured thoughts. And it turns out that your brain actually goes into a different mode. It's called the default mode network. And that's when we start really reflecting on our lives and really kind of getting, synthesizing ideas in new ways. And a lot of innovation happens that way, but it needs to be unstructured. And the question is, how can you create structured, unstructured time?
That's what we do. The cool thing about the structure of an evening at Second City, the sort of classic evening, is that it's a two-act, generally scripted review that is followed by a free late-night improv set. And I always, I've referred to that as like our failure lab. I think you could certainly call it a you know, 40 minutes of chaos. But it is where pure invention happens. Anything can happen. And contextually speaking, what was brilliant, and look, the people who created this were all, they were intellectuals from the University of Chicago, but I don't think they had this design principle in mind. But what they really did was set up by having it be free, having it late at night. It allowed for context that let the unstructure become a virtue and gave people practice in being essentially unpracticed.
That's super interesting. And I think from an organizational perspective and even from a corporate perspective, no one ever gets fired for not innovating. Right?
Right.
So there's this incentive to create a bureaucracy and to essentially just not mess up. And the question becomes then, how do you foster that level of creativity? And I find that it's often not necessarily one individual having a eureka moment, but rather creating a network and letting unusual suspects within that network innovate in marginal ways. And you don't know who's going to have the good idea, but you need to be able to capture it and then amplify that success.
Yeah, so let's talk about unusual suspects. You talk of them, they don't seem to belong in the field they're in, but they tend to weave together disparate worlds. I find this very interesting, especially reading the recent research that I've seen around expert bias. And I know this for myself, like, you know, when I was knee deep into my, you know, third decade of working at Second City, I had it down. But it wasn't until I sort of removed myself from the equation that I was able to look and go, no, I was actually, you know, getting in my own way and following my same patterns, and I wasn't innovating. So how can an unusual suspect come in and innovate in that kind of situation?
One of my favorite stories is from this hospital in Philadelphia, the Albert Einstein Medical Center.
Yeah.
And one of the challenges that hospitals face is hospital-acquired infection. And it kills lots of people every year. And it's, in order to prevent it, it's pretty easy. You just have to kind of wash your hands. And the hospital tried to get doctors and nurses to wash their hands, so they put up signs over the sink saying, remember to wash your hands. And that didn't really work. So they put up bigger signs, remember, wash your hands. And that didn't really work. And you really think about that, information doesn't really change behavior.
Right.
If it did, all of us would floss, none of us would smoke. And instead, what the Albert Einstein Medical Center did was they assembled a group, everyone from the head of infection control to the janitor. And in one of these meetings, a janitor noticed that in a wing where there was a lot of infection, the garbage cans were kind of empty. No one was using gloves. We're like, well, that's kind of strange. Why is that? And there's a model where nothing about me without me. So rather than saying they messed up or they went, and we actually talked to the people in that wing. We said, why are you using gloves? Don't you know? Gloves are really important to prevent infection. He said, well, in this wing, the nurses have extra small hands. And this hospital is so cheap, they won't get us enough extra small gloves. Said, well, what if we just give you more extra small gloves? And then I said, well, of course, then we'd use them. The janitor busts out a pen, writes his number on the wall, and says, anytime you run out of gloves, you just give me a call. And it was small incremental changes like that that reduced infections by 70% in 1 year. Now, it's not to say that every single wing needed extra small gloves.
Right.
Nor is it to say that the janitor should have been promoted to head of infection control. But it's creating this mode where you're allowing people to actually contribute, to actually have a voice, and picking out these unusual suspects when they have a really clever and smart innovation.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of people, when you talk about planning serendipity, they would be like, well, that's counterintuitive. It's not really serendipity. But really what you're doing is designing encounters where there can be really fruitful collisions. And that's sometimes putting people in a room who wouldn't normally be in a room. I remember talking to Michael Slaby, who was the chief technology officer for the Obama campaign. And they talked quite a bit about one of the reasons they were able to be successful is that tech was in the room at the beginning, which is usually not the case. And so we have some control. We have some nudges. And your stories just like illustrate that incredibly. I shifting a little bit to you talk about sort of education as well. You talk about the importance of recess. Why is recess important?
It's a wide space within the educational system. Mm-hmm. For people to actually have interactions with unusual suspects, to let our brains go into the default mode network, yeah. And to see things from a different perspective. So at work, we may not have recess where we're going to run around a schoolyard, but how often do you go for a walk when you have a complex problem that you need to figure out?
Right.
How often do you just change the context and allow yourself to interact with one another in a more playful way that actually ends up being much more effective for the organizational goals?
I want to also talk to you about the neurobiology of insight, and I think that's your phrase. We've been doing some work in the area of insight and humor comprehension, and there was a recent fMRI study that linked the part of the brain that processes a joke to the same part of the brain that forms an insight. And it feels to me like you're playing, we're playing kind of in a similar area that you talk about in that world.
Absolutely. So when your brain, when you think that your brain is shut off, so that is when you're just staring out into space or daydreaming or riding in a car and just looking out the window, your brain is actually doing a heck of a lot of processing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's doing kind of a sort of housekeeping. And all these different parts of the brain that don't necessarily talk to each other on a regular basis, start communicating.
Mm-hmm.
And what they start doing is they start reflecting and making meaning of the narrative that we've been experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of these different parts of the brain talking to each other that you sometimes have insights, because you really are, in a way, creating unusual suspects, right? And mm-hmm. serendipity, where you're having conversations within your brain that wouldn't necessarily happen if you were constantly staying on task. And one of the things I've started forcing myself to do is, if I'm in a car, and let's say I'm in an Uber or something like that, I will force myself to not be buried in my phone, to not be busy, to not be productive, to just look out the window, and to let my brain do what it's kind of meant to do, which is process and reflect and imagine things in a new way. So think about that. How much time do you spend every day allowing your default mode network to get activated?
Right. Not as adults, hardly at all, I think, for most people. I know when I started doing public speaking, my first couple times out, I would script it, which sounds funny now, given my background. And I found out that I'm not a good memorizer, and I just happened to be reading some of Adam Grant's work where he talked about the positive effects of procrastination. And so what I would allow myself to do is just what you talked about. I would take walks with my stories and take walks with my ideas. And then when I sort of got to the point of I would beat out kind of a rough outline on paper so I knew what that kind of looked like, and then I would just sort of go, and it was immensely freeing, and I was tapping into a lot of new stuff that would come up even during my talks.
Absolutely. I had the same experience when I started giving talks. The part of you that thinks that, like, well, you know, I'm in front of a large group of people and I'm supposed to be the expert, and
right.
that you, I find myself becoming boring and trying to be precise.
Yeah.
And it's only when I kind of reminded myself of my own theories in the books about letting go of control a little bit, that I started doing the same, thinking about a presentation in terms of related stories rather than a bunch of graphs and bullet points.
Mm-hmm.
So I forced myself when I do a presentation to only use pictures.
Yeah. Huh.
Because pictures force me to tell a story, and it's amazing how easily we remember a story as opposed to reading slides off a deck.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Okay, you live in the West Coast. You're a vegan, right?
I'm vegan. I've been vegan since I was 16.
Okay. So West Coast vegan, like, and not just West Coast, right? Like San Francisco, Berkeley, that kind of thing?
I started vegan.org. I teach at UC Berkeley. I live in San Francisco.
Yeah, all right. So you're...
You can guess my politics, right?
Right. You guess your politics. I know your type. And yet, you have just co-written a book with, you know, with, like, top army guy. So what... And you tell some of this origin story in your work, and you've done a lot of work with the army. But what an unlikely pairing. And I'm wondering how quickly you were able to establish trust when you went into those conversations.
Surprisingly fast, and I have immense respect for the military. What's interesting is 8 years ago, I heard from this guy in the Army, and up to that point, I had never had a conversation with anyone in uniform.
Hmm.
And it wasn't like I'd been living under a rock. I mean, granted, UC Berkeley, but still. And it was this four-star general. My first question was, is there a five-star general? And apparently there isn't. And I didn't know how to address him, so I called him Marty.
Yeah.
And he invited me over. At the time, this is Marty Dempsey. He was in charge of leadership at the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And he invited me over to the base he commanded and talked to me about how the Army was figuring out that in order to effectively fight decentralized networks, it needed to become more networked and decentralized itself,
mm-hmm.
and that the Army was looking at uncertain futures. So what it needed to do is it needed to be able to imagine a future that hasn't happened yet, and how can we better foster imagination within the Army. And in that conversation, we instantly hit it off, and we talked about this challenge of how do you move a very, very large organization to make it more creative and agile.
Mm-hmm.
And we started an experiment where we created different networks within the U.S. Army, working on a variety of subjects in order to really make the Army more agile, and especially when it was figuring out complex issues. From how do you encourage women to be promoted within the ranks,
mm-hmm.
to how do you engender creativity when people come back from overseas assignments and all of a sudden they're dealing with all of the structure of big army, if you will.
So this is a thing, right, that in many of our high-performance professions, you know, doctors, policemen, people protecting our country, Army, that they have a sort of a strict code of conduct that they need to attain. They've got to go to medical school. They've got to get their answers right. They have to shift their mind into this, like, I really need to understand all this massive amount of information. But then when they're thrown into the sort of crisis work, they have to improvise. And many of them aren't getting any of that kind of training.
Right. And that's the thing that surprised me the most, actually, is that the Army, on when they're in action, they're highly improvisational.
Yeah, yeah.
It's when they come back and they have to deal with the big bureaucracy, that's where the challenges start to happen. So the question is, how do you train people to be improvisational? And how do you capture the improvisation and creativity that they might have on the battleground when they come back home and try to tackle on different issues. One of the things that we've worked on is we created a partnership between UC Berkeley and the Pentagon, two unlikely, unusual suspects. Uh-huh. And we bring a group of 30 Army officers and enlisted folks to UC Berkeley for 2 weeks. And those conversations are so fascinating because all of a sudden you have people who typically aren't talking to each other, who typically aren't interacting. And especially these days in our country, how do you foster this level of conversation, and how do you then nurture the great ideas that come out of there? Because a part of this is allowing people to be improvisational, but another part is, as a leader, how do you amplify and reward the successes?
Yeah, yeah. Some of the work that we've done in our partnership at the University of Chicago, we work with the Center for Decision Research and a bunch of behavioral scientists around improvisation and behavioral science. And when what we've sort of discovered, we have this yes and philosophy, but that doesn't really cover things when you have like huge ideological differences or really thorny problems. You just can't yes and your way out of it. And the idea that we sort of came up with based on the science was it's really more of a thank you because at that point. Thank you to offer some level of gratitude for someone sharing something that maybe is very opposite where I stand. And the because is important because that allows you to frame what they just said in your own words. They might help you get it right. And that's immensely pleasing to our minds if we're both doing it. That can possibly allow us to stay inside a difficult conversation.
It's super interesting. And I think one of the interesting things that emerges from this is it's really about allowing ourselves to be both more open and also to slow down the conversation a little.
Right.
And to, I found, at least with my work with the Army, I found that when you really slow down, when I really slow down, I found that my friends in the Army and my friends at Berkeley who are running nonprofits are actually surprisingly similar in terms of their values. Mm-hmm. And when you take away politics, there's much more that unites us than really divides us.
Right.
And it's about how do you find those core beliefs that are similar across across sectors.
So in our in the work I was just talking about, we have this exercise called I'm Somebody Who. And what we do is we gather people in a circle and we start with something observational, like I'm somebody who's wearing black. And then when you say that, you need to move to another part of the circle. But anyone else who identifies with that statement also moves. And then you move it to like I'm somebody who jogs or I'm somebody who is raised Catholic. And you get a little deeper into it to being I'm somebody who believes in climate change or you know I'm someone who traditionally votes conservative and all that stuff. And what we discover is that people start to figure out, oh, wait a sec, the guy who believes in climate change also owns a gun and plays soccer. Oh, that's a mix I didn't expect. And so what we're hoping people experience when they start to figure out that individuation part, you know, that people are more than maybe you're making them out to be. And once you understand that, that gives you a point to work from.
It adds so much color to the equation, right?
Yeah.
I love that exercise. My version of it is anybody who, anybody who's ever blank. I've done it with the Army, and it's amazingly, you're exactly right, it's amazingly interesting, and the people who you'd last expect to have a view or have an experience actually kind of come out in more, I think about it as people start looking more 3D. Than two-dimensional.
I think it's either Kahneman or Tversky who said people are not so complicated, it's relationships between people that are complicated.
yeah.
And I think that that's true. So talk to us about Radical Inclusion, this new book, because the blurb I saw says that you talk about relinquishing control to preserve power. And I don't know if that's one aspect of many, but I thought it was really an interesting idea.
So Radical Inclusion is coming out March 6th. And as I said, I wrote the book with Marty Dempsey.
Mm-hmm.
And we look at inclusion as not just a nice to have, but as a strategic imperative.
Mm-hmm.
And that you need inclusion in order to be more effective. We look at control and we need to recognize that we pay an economic cost to exert control.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you invest, if you get 49% ownership of a company versus 50% ownership, there's a 20% premium to get 50% versus 49. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense that there's benefits that come from having control. But we really need to be rigorous about, is exerting control always worth it? And are we sometimes losing power when we try to exert too much control, when we try to go at it alone, when we try to make the specific outcome that we have in mind? Mm-hmm. And we argue that inclusion serves you in two specific ways. The first is that it enables you to better gather information from the edges of the network. Mm-hmm. And that you're able to get more accurate information, again, from unlikely sources who otherwise wouldn't be in the room. And if they're not in the room, they're not going to be surprised by. So we might have a huge stream of data, and we might get all this data, but you need someone who's going to be surprised by a certain element of data to then raise their hand and say, like, look, you actually need to pay attention to this. And the second thing that inclusion does is it enables us to better promote and the second thing that inclusion does is it enables us to better channel our message through the organization to have more stickiness to that, because you need a bunch of different voices, all in sync, talking about a specific message. And what we tend to do in organizations is we tend to distribute the what and concentrate the how. Mm-hmm. So we get a bunch of people to vote on what the company should do or what the organization should do, and then we're very, very specific about this is how you should execute it. Mm-hmm. And what we argue is that it's more effective to actually concentrate the what. It needs to be just a few people deciding what are the organizational goals. And then you distribute the how. You let a bunch of people figure out how do you get towards those goals.
Wow, that's really interesting. And the first part of that in terms of getting to truth with the sort of inclusion in different voices reminds me of some of the stuff that Dacre Keltner has talked about, where poor people are probably observationally much more understanding of the truth because they have to be. And that sort of pivot of, like, you know, so you, when you're talking about inclusion, I think you're talking about a very wide swath. It could be economic, it could be racial, it could be age, right? It's across the board.
Absolutely. It reminds me of a story that Ross Perot told in his book when he was the director of GM on the board of GM, and all the board directors would get a car, and they'd get a new car every year. And this is like during the 80s where GM wasn't producing, let's just say they weren't producing the highest quality vehicles. Uh-huh. And every time there was a board meeting, the cars would get serviced. They'd get new fluids and they'd get a tune-up, and et cetera, et cetera. That meant that the board never recognized how crappy GM's cars were at the time. Hmm. Because their cars ran perfectly. They didn't feel the pain.
Right.
So the question is, how do you expand the circle and get enough people, whether it's users, whether it's customers, whether it's people from different parts of the organization, to actually be able to give us a better sense of what's really going on the ground?
Yep, so true. Okay, so we're running close to the end here, and I always close by asking my guests for a yes and story, a time in their life where they might have normally said no, but they said yes and what happened. Before I get to that question, so I'm kind of giving you some time if you want to think about that, there's a few different little nuggets that I picked up that I kind of want to just have you respond to right away, because I just thought they were really smart and interesting. So I have had this love-hate relationship with open offices, and it was more of a hate relationship. Like, you would think it would be the opposite, that the improv guy would be all about it, but I wasn't finding ones that worked in my my experience. And yet I visited Bloomberg's office a couple years back, and that's one that I felt worked. And you kind of say why in the book.
Bloomberg is a wonderful example. He basically sits in, when he was mayor, he would sit in the pit in the middle of the office. Mm-hmm. And anyone who wanted to and his staff could have direct access to him. So this wasn't a, oftentimes in open offices, you know, just rows and rows and rows of of tables, and people put on headphones to distract from the noise.
Yep.
But you don't really necessarily have access, again, to the decision maker and to the person that you actually need to have access to.
Mm-hmm.
Bloomberg's methodology was incredibly effective because it takes the best of both worlds, right? You concentrate the what about what the city's priorities are, but mm-hmm. you distribute the how with the people around him being able to advise him real time on how to best execute.
Yeah, great. All right, here's another one. There's all this innovation in Silicon Valley, you talk about the fact that that is related to not allowing non-compete clauses in California.
This comes from the Gold Rush era, where California basically doesn't have any non-compete. And that means that you have unusual suspects pollinating from company to company to company. And it's that introduction of unusual suspects that leads to serendipity and to creativity. I also think that when we look at Silicon Valley, typically, we look at two things. We look at money, and we look at tech. Mm-hmm. But I think there is three other elements of what's happening in Silicon Valley that needs to be appreciated. We need to look up north to San Francisco and the arts culture, and see how that's impacted the creativity of Silicon Valley.
Right.
We need to look at what's happening at Berkeley and the idea of imagination, imagining a world in which civil rights exist, or imagining a world where there's gold in the hills.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we also need to look seriously at Burning Man,
mm-hmm.
and look at how Burning Man, in a lot of ways, is the underpinning soul of the valley. It's a very yes and culture.
Yep.
And you have a bunch of big CEOs from Google to Facebook talking about how Burning Man very much impacted their own thinking and their ability to interact with unusual suspects. And that we need to look at it as an entire ecosystem of not just money and tech, but money, tech, arts, imagination, and a soul.
Okay, great. And my last, before I get to the yes and question for you. So I've been kicking around this idea, and I don't know if it ultimately has merit, but a few people have found it interesting. And when you look at Chicago and what we have contributed over the years to sort of, let's say, the innovation space, certainly improvisation we're well known for, house music we're well known for, slam poetry we're well known for, the blues. All those particular art forms are particularly unownable. You can't own an improvisation. And just like the blues are basically the same chords over and over, very hard to own. And you've talked about this in terms of like property rights can sometimes screw up stuff. And I wonder that if in Chicago, because we are a bit of the flyover, we're not New York and we're not LA, people are generally beginning their careers here and then move to make their money elsewhere. If there isn't something in the idea of when it's unownable, truly that's a space in which innovation can absolutely flourish.
I think that very well may be. And the idea that because it's unownable, people are more likely to share, more likely to collaborate, more likely to improvise, and more likely then to innovate. I think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Okay, great. All right. So, final question. This concept of yes and improvisation is all about like when you're improvising or you're making something out of nothing, the one way to not do that is by saying no, that just doesn't work. And you can't even just say yes, but you have to say yes and. It's kind of a leap into the unknown, a collective leap into the unknown. And I'm wondering if you've got a moment in your life where you really, had to yes and maybe that was a pivot from where you were before.
Yes, in 2005, one of my good friends from business school said that they were going to this festival in the desert, Burning Man. And I was like, what? You're doing what? And this sounds nuts. And they're like, no, come. Come. It's going to be good for you. And I was like, I've been kind of in a structured environment. Sure, yes, and let me not just go, but let me get involved in a camp that created a art car. And this car was a Ford Escort, and we built a deck around it, and you basically sit on top of the deck and you drive using sticks on the gas brakes and
wow.
steering wheel. And then on top of that was a 30-foot tall giraffe. So I was like, yes, and let me, and I knew nothing about engineering or carpentry, and I was like, yeah, let me just be, try to contribute. And we were sitting in the desert, rolling around, and you go at 5 miles an hour on this giraffe, and this guy yells at us, like, hey, you, and he looks like the guy, kind of guy that I would run away from if mm-hmm. it was late at night.
Yeah.
He has these, he's wearing this horn cap and kind of this big, burly guy. And rather than kind of running away, I was like, yeah, hi, how's it going? And he's like, you guys need some snow cones. Like, all right, we need some snow cones. And my brother gives me a lot of grief for going to Burning Man. He's like, you know, you're paying hundreds of dollars to go and use porta potties and be in the middle of the desert. And I'm like,
yeah.
Yes, but you need to also understand that people start acting very differently when there's less structure and when there's a gift economy. So this isn't when he gave us the snow cones, it wasn't in order to get us lured into a timeshare or right. because he wanted anything in return. It's just a gift economy. And it really changed my perspective on what happens when you come from a place of trying to gift, trying to participate in the overall success of the event, and allowing yourself to yes and. And I feel Burning Man definitely shaped my views and perspective on what happens when we really form a community around slightly different rules and how different that community might look.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, it allows you to get out of yourself and your norms and your boundaries, and allows you to play with decentralization. You know, you're not going all in because that's scary, but it gives you a chance to sort of play in that area.
Absolutely. And really wonderful, interesting things come out of that.
Yeah. Ori Brafman, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.